of a day when youth will pass away. What will they say about me when the end comes? I know there's no place to take a loss. Life goes on without me.
This is the Extra Hot Gray Podcast, episode 424 for the week of September 12, 2022. I am sink unclogger David T. Cole, and I'm here with Assault Blackout Sarah D. Bunting.
How'd these bees get here?
Lonely old bag Tara Ariano.
I think he really likes me, though.
And moody cover singer Sarah Baker.
Don't call me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we get into today's festivities, a little bit of podcast business up top. If you are a patron of this podcast, number one, thank you for your support. It means the world to us. And number two, we have something new for you in the perks department. Perks. That is free stickers. Well, free if you're a member. So technically, I suppose they're not free. But it's just suddenly, bam, it's a new perk. All you have to do is be a patron. You're going to go to a Google form that we have created for you. You're going to say, yes, I want the Extra Hot Great sticker. Yes, I want Is This Worse Than Jazz sticker. And yes, I want the, Sarah,
Space
sticker. All three. If you want all three, are yours for the having. All you have to do is go to that form, put in your name and your address is confidential. And then we put them on the envelope. We put the stamp on the envelope and we send it to you. And then you put them on your laptop, on your water bottle, on your children's forehead, wherever you want to put those. That is now available. Asterisk. We actually did one run. We sold out. The other run is expected in a couple days. By the time you hear this, the form might be back up or a day away from being back up. Check Patreon for all the details.
Now, let us welcome in our guest. She is an actor you have seen in The Kominsky Method and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. You've also heard her in Bob's Burgers in the Great North. You've also heard her on this very podcast. It's Sarah Baker. Welcome, Sarah.
Yay. Thanks for having me.
We're thrilled to have you to discuss American Gigolo, the series. In 2006, a Los Angeles sex worker named Julian Kay, John Bernthal, wakes up next to the corpse of one of his clients. He has no recollection of what happened, but Detective Joan Sunday, Rosie O'Donnell, who's investigating the case, convinces him to save his life and plead guilty. But wouldn't you know it, 15 years later, a hitman on his deathbed confesses to several murders, including the one Julian is locked up for. Julian is exonerated, but he has other problems. The woman he loves is still married to a powerful scumbag. His mother is crippled with guilt over selling him to his pimp when he was still a teenager, and he's not sure what he's going to do with the rest of a life he didn't think he'd have. The show, which premiered on Showtime Sunday night, is sometimes loosely and sometimes very closely based on Paul Schrader's movie of the same name. While Schrader is credited as a consultant, the series was created by David Hollander, formerly an EP on Ray Donovan, although he was fired from the show in April while it was already in production after some apparently not sexual misconduct-related complaints. His name is still on at least the first three screeners. I guess we'll see if and when that changes if we continue to watch, which it may not happen. Only the first episode has aired so far. I've seen the first three. I will be cool about spoilers, even though no one
cares.
Thanks,
Tara.
Yeah. Let's do the Chen check-in. Sarah Baker, should our listeners watch this show?
Respectfully, no.
Sarah D. Bunting.
That's an excellent way to put it. Respectfully, no. I don't think so.
Dave. Yeah. It's
it's
a no for me as well, and not a really respectful one, and we'll get into it. I'll admit, I had not watched the movie American Gigolo until we knew we were going to be talking about the show. But I did watch Ray Donovan for longer than I should have. Therefore, I know it was packed top to bottom with female characters that the show definitely wanted you to hate. Yes.
How many episodes is longer than you should have?
Like almost the first season, I think. Yeah. This was a time when we hardly got any screeners. And anytime we did, I was like, we better watch this. And then I got over that. I feel like this show also hates female characters. Unlike in the movie, every woman in this Julian's life is inadequate at best and a child sex trafficker at worst. The least objectionable one is Detective Sunday. She's the one who is largely responsible for Julian being wrongly convicted of murder, as we've previously said. Sarah Baker, was this something you notice as well, or am I letting my Ray Donovan loathing cross over into this show?
Well, I have no knowledge of Ray Donovan or John Bernthal, but I mean, this show is crazy. I mean, it's literally about, you know, pedophilia and stuff. And at first, like the first half, I was like, okay, I don't watch a lot of dramas. Like, they're going for that heavy drama thing. But then it got so soapy. I was like, this is about like child sex abuse and exploitation. Mm-hmm. And in that guy's credit, I did think he did a good job. I mean, I felt for him as much as you could, but man, it was rough.
Sarah, what did you think?
As one of the few people still watching Law & Order Special Victims Unit, this was not that, like, it. I mean, it's dark and it's rough stuff, but my issue with it was more like, it had a certain noir stylishness to it in the first half of the first episode, like Sarah Baker said. But by the end of the first episode, you sort of have the whodunit framed out, and it's just a question of how they're going to spend the next bunch of episodes getting there.
Yeah.
And while this sort of kaleidoscope of flashbacks was pretty well done and pretty effective and not annoying, I can't keep going with that because we're already, like, we already know how it ends, kind of. And it's just a matter of, like, filling in all the pieces in the backstory. And I'm not quite interested in this very woman-hating, like Tara said, just, like, completely somber, which I think it probably feels like it has to be because, you know, child sex trafficking.
Right.
But, like, even the darkest noir does have some wit to it. And this is what, like, most of the reviews say, and this is what I keep coming back to, like, just this, you know, frown emoji over everything. Mm-hmm. Like, Bernthal could be doing better with this if it weren't so dark, but I think it's just this unrelieved performance he feels like he has to give.
Right.
Yeah, something is out of balance for me with it, and I'm not going to stick around and see if it corrects itself.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the marketing for the show is that it's very of a piece with what we see in, like, the opening credits, where it's like, and of a piece with the movie, where it's like, here's this really cool guy in sexy suits driving a cool car around the PCH, like, taking women back to whatever this lair is that the Sandrine Holt has set up. And then the show is like, does not fulfill that at all. And in the movie, which famously stars Richard Gere, truly never hotter, by the way. I cannot recommend the movie enough. It's on Paramount Plus right now. We basically don't know anything about Julian's backstory other than that when he tells his Michelle, who's played by Lauren Hutton in the movie, that he studied French in Nantes. It's probably not true, but they've added this horrible backstory to the TV Julian. Like, did you find this compelling, or was it just another way to, like, stigmatize sex work, which was not present in the movie at all?
Again, here again, felt like they quote, had to make his or anyone else's presence in the world of sex work a result of trauma.
Trauma, yeah.
And I'm just not sure that that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, about 40 minutes into it, I was like, I just wish I were watching, like, The Girlfriend Experience instead, or just something that was a little more sort of, like, thoughtful and curious about this world versus, you know, everything here needs to be treated like a therapeutic outcome.
Right.
I just don't see how you can dip your toe lightly into those kinds of issues. And that's what it felt to me like it did. Melora Walters, I think, is actually always great, and she's going to come up later when we talk about Pen 15.
Yep.
But we don't know anything about why she was such a monster. I mean, she seems like kind of a mess, but they also show them having happy times. And I don't know. I just don't think you can dip your toe into something like your mother trafficking you and acting as your pimp and then selling you and that just be like, oh, it's just a little peppering of his backstory. That feels disrespectful to me, I guess.
I was also curious of, like, how did this extremely powerful, elegant pimp from Los Angeles even find this kid in the desert? Like, did Melora Walters have an ad for him in the Penny Saver that like Sandrine Holt found? Because it's crazy that these two, that the any of these characters ever cross paths.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also wondered that. Like, does she have a, like, she didn't send a drone, but right. That was sort of my, that it's like, does she sit in a limo, like, on the nearest interstate, like, on the shoulder and just send a drone out to right. look for likely candidates?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the performances, starting with John Bernthal, who I interviewed Rosie O'Donnell for Vanity Fair, and we'll link it in the show notes. And she referred to him at one point as John Bernthal, which I thought was cute. Like, you made 10 episodes of the show with this guy, never learned his name. All right. I thought his meekness in the present day was well done and really showed his range after We Own This City. Sarah, you at least, Sarah Bunting, watched the first one of those. What did you think of him here in terms of what you've already said? You wished he was doing more, but other than that.
Yeah, I feel like he keeps showing up in things and I keep feeling like, first of all, disconcerted that this is not like a clone of Fred Ward, because it's, to me, like, mm-hmm. strikingly close. But also that I think that he keeps being cast in things because he has a certain physical presence.
Yeah.
His acting ability is beyond could be allowed to go beyond mm-hmm. What he's been cast for physically.
Yeah.
Not that I would have minded seeing more of John Bernthal, you know, without a shirt. But
sure.
I also kind of felt like he was constricted by certain, you know, again, emotional obligations that the writing felt like it had. Mm-hmm. But yet, like, the performances aren't really the problem here. And, like, Rosie is actually really great,
mm-hmm.
I thought. And I kind of was like, okay, if this is still unsolved, like, let's send them on a road trip. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that'll give it a little bit of pep.
Yeah.
He's good. Like, I just think tonally, they had some shit to sort out before they started shooting that they did not sort out.
Yeah.
And the performances are all going to sort of be laboring under that, particularly like Lizzie Brochuret, who, like, she's always good. But again, she's such a virago.
Yeah.
It's like, what can you bring?
Yeah.
To this, like, I'm surprised they didn't put actual, like, vampire fangs and claws on her. Like, oh my fucking God, we get it. She's bad.
Yes. Just a sidebar, because I don't think we need to talk very much more about her character, but the girl who plays young Isabel is named Harlow Happy Hexham, and that's not okay with me.
Mm-mm.
What? No.
That sounds like the sequel to, what was that cult movie? Like,
Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Martha Marcy May.
Martha Marcy Harlow Happy Hex and Marlene. Yeah.
Oy.
Even Marlene-ier.
Sarah Baker, what did you think of what John Bernthal was given to do?
Well, what he was given to do was tough. I mean, what I thought there were, like Sarah said, there was a lot of just so many tonal problems mm-hmm. for me. It felt like somebody was like, make it sexier, make it soapier. And somebody else was like, no, this is a drama. We want to sink our teeth into it. And so that was what was tough for me. Rosie O'Donnell, I felt, was good. I mean, mm-hmm. the scene where she comes in, like, shaking the bed, I was like, okay, that was the take where the director was like, really go for it, you know, just, and it felt a little like trying too hard to be the, you know, bad cop or whatever.
Right.
Mm.
But for the most part, I thought she was good. And I love Rosie O'Donnell. I'm one of those people that just, mm-hmm. I do like her. But acting wise, I thought she did a good job. I loved kind of her look and everything. And, you know, and John Bernthal, I thought he did the best he could with what he have. He's definitely, I watch so many comedies. I've never really seen him before. Mm-hmm. He's very attractive, very appealing. He does manage to carry that little bit of, like, sexy fun, like, oh, he's living the life, I guess. It's fine, you know?
Yeah.
And then, obviously, we see things go deeper. But even him, I actually questioned the direction. If this is a director that ever wants to hire me, I take it all back. But there were just moments where they were like, go ahead, improvise. Like, just get loose with it. And that's such a problem now where the writing gets so loose.
Wayne Brady's like, yes!
I know. Poor Wayne Brady. That's Wayne Brady. Now, I only watched like 10 minutes of the movie just because mm-hmm. I ran out of time. But also I was like, this movie is weird. But felt so flat, felt like toneless. Mm-hmm. But I need to watch more, clearly. But Wayne Brady was a big improvement on his counterpart in the movie, from what I could see. And I, you know, again, being an actor, I like seeing somebody get the opportunity to do something they don't normally do.
Yeah.
But if you have Wayne Brady, who normally like hosts a game show and does musical theater, like, help him out. Like, when there's this big confession of like, oh, I think I killed somebody when I was a kid. He's like, nah, you probably didn't. Okay, good night.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah, that was
so crazy. Like, how do you play that realistically, you know? Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if anyone else also had problems with, I don't know how to put this exactly, but like, at first I was not clear when we were supposed to be.
Yes.
In this. And it's sort of fine to have it be out of time. But when they're showing Rosie in the flashbacks and it's sort of like there's this, you know, Cagney and Lacey vibe to her outfit. And it's like, when are we? But then the cars look pretty modern. And I'm like, I don't know when we are.
Yeah.
Then we're talking about DNA. And
no,
I
but there's three time periods in this first episode. There is the... There is 2006, there is almost present day.
Right.
And then there is the flashbacks to, like, you know, it's mid-teens or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't do anything with the actors between 2006 and 2021 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And those scenes, there's a lot of scenes where, like, I know it's lazy, but I felt like if you're not going to do something with the actors, either... soft lens, de-aging, or whatever for the 2006 stuff.
Give us a Chiron, you know?
Throw us a Mexico filter. Give us a Mexico filter. Let us hit us over the head. Do a Better Call Saul, black and white.
Yes.
My issue was more like, I think the movie was made at a time where the way we thought about sex work, the way we thought about the assault... And inappropriate relationships, like that was completely different. And it's Paul Schrader. Like, I think that it's a completely different time. It literally was. It was over 40 years ago.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if anyone else felt like here in 2022 with this material, they were trying to be more... inclusive or correct or something in a way that, like, for this material, it's like, you know, tonally, again, you really have to figure out what you're trying to do, and they didn't.
Yeah,
did anyone
absolutely.
Else feel like they shouldn't have tried to translate a property from 1980?
Yeah, I feel like if you work it backwards, the way to say it is, back in the 80s, they were able to have their cake and eat it too, because there wasn't an awareness or a compunction to tackle this from a trauma POV. Whereas today, if you remade American Gigolo, the movie, as a series, tonally, people would be like, you know, you are just sweeping things under the rug.
I don't know. You know, P-Valley is, it's not sex work exactly, but it's sex work adjacent. And it's just sort of like, it takes this job as a job at face value. Like, not everyone is necessarily doing it willingly, but it's a different thing where it's just like, this is work. And, you know, every job has things about it that are kind of crappy. Like, but one of the things that American Gigolo the movie is about, among others, is that, like, when you do work that's outside of the, you know, the bounds of the law, there are certain protections that you're not going to have. And this is why, part of why that Julian, you know, gets framed for murder is because he's not going to have the same protection from police because of what his job is. Whereas this is just like, as I said up top, like, pop culture creators love to, you know, stigmatize sex work. And one of the ways to do that is to be like, everyone who does it is fucked up. And that's not necessarily true.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about this just really bleak subplot with Gretchen Mol's kid and his teacher? Do we just want to...
Like, what? They were just like, let's throw everything in, you know?
Exactly. Yes. And that goes back to my initial point of, like, every woman in this is bad. Basically, the mom is bad for not paying enough attention, and the teacher's bad for molesting a child.
And she's day drinking. Don't forget that.
Yes, and she has a wig with bangs.
but still hair under. Like, that there were so many things that I was like, this is just needlessly confusing. Mm-hmm. And the whole Gretchen Mol thing, maybe it's me, maybe I you know, maybe I'm the kind of person that really needs that Chiron to tell me where and when we are.
Yeah.
But when she first was introduced, I thought we were in the current time for a little bit. So then yeah. I was like, oh, I thought she was going to be set up to be like his old girlfriend. Anyway, I figured it out, but it took me a second of like, mm-hmm. wait, who is this? And the fact that then there's all these layers on top of this character, I was like, I mean, it is a pilot and you know, I didn't watch the second or third episode, so maybe they just felt like they needed to stack a lot in to then explore throughout the series. But for the pilot, it felt like there's just way too much jammed in here and so much backloaded. You know, yeah. there was so much in the last, like, 20 minutes that was just like, wait, now this too? Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, when they walked in on that woman, like, cowering displayed in the living room, like, I was like, is she kidnapped? Wait, is that the old version of the... I mean, it just seemed insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Poor Sandrine Holt, trapped in yet another B-.
I know.
Eek.
It is time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
Back in March, one of my plugs was for a piece that I did for Decider about the return of primetime soaps on network, and then all four of the ones that I wrote about got canceled. Like that in the show notes again. But Fox is hoping things are going to be different this time for its new soap, Monarch, because that is basically all of those shows, plus Nashville and that Kim Cattrall show, Filthy Rich, that we talked about in 2020.
Oh, my
in a
God,
Cuisinart.
That thing.
Exactly. So, Monarch. Trace Adkins and Susan Sarandon play Albie and Dottie Roman, legendary country stars of decades. Their daughter, Nikki, played by Anna Friel, is a moderately successful solo artist. Their son, Luke, some dude I've never seen before, I'm not going to learn his name, runs their record label. Their other daughter, Gigi, Beth Ditto, has turned her back on the business and runs a honky-tonk bar instead. And at first, it seems like the reason Dottie never pushed Gigi harder to have a music career is because she's fat. But then we learn Gigi's also a lesbian, but her wife is fooling around with her brother. And speculation swirling about why Albie's stepping away from touring, the prevailing rumors that he's dying, but it turns out actually Dottie is dying. And she asks Nikki to help her die by suicide at the end of the annual Roman family weekend, and she does. So I guess that's it for Susan Sarandon. We'll see. I cannot...
This sounds like light, soapy fun.
That's a Susan Saran rap.
Oh, there it is.
It is kind of soapy fun. I cannot overemphasize how lazy it is, though. The characters just state their issues and intentions in a way that no one ever would. Like, in the pilot alone, we get Luke asking Albie, when am I ever going to be enough? And Dottie telling Gigi, you're a strong woman and you know who you are. Like, this is not how people talk. But retread of a bunch of other shows that didn't go. As soon as we see Nikki's Australian actor husband say he has to go out of town for reshoots, we know for sure he is cheating on her, and he is. Just like the husband of the daughter who was taking over the vineyard in Promised Land. Dottie states that her whole career has been about establishing a dynasty, just like in Dynasty. We hear a lot about organizing a big tour, like in Queens. And apparently there are both parentage and murder scandals in the family's past, which is like our kind of people. And yet this is Fox's marquee show. They are airing it like two more times this week. They're putting a huge marketing push behind it, too. There's a signature whiskey pop-up or some fucking thing I read about on Variety. Ooh. There's simply no way it's going to last. But all that said, it's still the trash I am happily going to gobble up. I part of me after the pilot was like, I shouldn't bother getting invested in this because it's definitely going to get canceled. But then when I went to do my recordings, I am still going to record the next one. So take all that with a grain of salt. This might be the kind of garbage that you like to, I don't know, your life.
Garbage?
Yeah, garbage.
Yeah, I like that.
For my plugs, I have a couple because we were off last week. I interviewed Mark Proksch, who plays Colin Robinson on What We Do in the Shadows, and that's at VanityFair.com. It's after the finale, so it's very spoilery. Don't read it until if you watch the season four finale. If you don't want to get spoiled, it was good. He was good. And as you hear this, The Handmaid's Tale will have just premiered its fifth season at Hulu, and you can read my review of that at Vanity Fair, another show very, very different from Monarch, but also in my opinion, bad, and also something I will never stop watching. I mean, they're going to take that away from me because the sixth season is going to be its last. But yeah, again, my judgment, perhaps very suspect.
Sarah Baker, what do you have for us?
Well, I always seem to be on the cutting edge in my Around the Dial portion, and today's no different. I've been watching the obscure indies and very current Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore Show. I watched plenty of reruns when I was a kid, but there are certain shows that were either just old enough that they weren't in rotation anymore, or maybe just didn't happen to be on that day I was homesick from school. So I somehow never saw much of either of these shows. Now, I knew the Mary Tyler Moore Show was supposed to be great, but I just hadn't seen it. I saw Rhoda somehow. I guess my programmer in my hometown liked Rhoda better, which I loved and still love. But somehow I missed Mary Tyler Moore. And I think in the case of Dick Van Dyke, I stupidly just thought, oh, cool, some old black and white show, glomming it together in my mind with like Leave It to Beaver or something. Thanks to the Decades channel, which has a block featuring both of these shows, I've finally been educated. And I'm here to tell my fellow dummies who may have been missing out that they're both excellent, hilarious, with incredible characters portrayed by the most heavy-hitting cast. From Rosemary and Maury Amsterdam to Ted Knight and Cloris Leachman, there are zero duds in these casts. So check them out. And now, only because I want to copy Tara, I offer these more current picks: Highbrow, Severance on Apple Plus, and Lowbrow, Big Brother on CBS. Yes, I'm sorry, but I do still watch. I apologize.
I have to apologize. What would you like to plug?
Oh, and for my plugs, I mean, it feels like a long time ago to me now, but The Kaminsky Method just ended last year. That is on Netflix, if you care to peruse. It's only 3 seasons, a quick binge. And upcoming, I've been doing a lot of voiceover lately, so I am on Friends of the Show, Wendy Molyneux Drake's The Great North, and Bob's Burgers, not Big Brother.
Maybe someday.
Also friend of the show, Jeff Drake, Central Park.
Woo!
So I have those coming up.
We'll link all those in the show notes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh boy, speaking of 6-season shows that I should have quit, thank you to Tara for the advice that I should just bail on Handmaid's Tale, Animal Kingdom. My actual topic of discussion, I was not that smart. It finally ended last month. Similarly painstaking pace to the final season of Better Call Saul, but Animal Kingdom really could not justify that. And I had a whole thing written out analyzing why the last half of this series felt superfluous. And then I was like, well, I'm not sure anyone not involved with the show even kept watching it, so who cares? But I did want to make one point about it. I have spent a lot of time over the last couple of seasons complaining in reviews and elsewhere about flashback Smurf / Janine, as played by Layla George, and how her whole sexy brat portrayal of this gangster godmother did not work for me because it didn't really credibly explain how a character with exactly 2 traits, number one, being a dick, and number two, not wearing a bra, came to command an entire surf town before she could leverage her borderline incestuous thrall over her rockhead adult sons. And for quite a while, I was blaming this on Layla George's performance and not really understanding how a child of Vincent D'Onofrio could be this unrelenting of a C+ in such an interesting role. But I owe Layla George an apology because it is clear to me now that the fault lies with the writing. Nobody remembers this either because this happened like 5 years ago, but the show gave the original present-day Smurf, Ellen Barkin, the gate because basically they thought she was too old to be hot and interesting.
No.
Or at least that's what she thought the reason was and was pretty public about objecting to that. At this point, I really don't disagree because it's clear that the show's interest in Smurf's, quote, origin story is an utterly male-gaze conception of what might give a woman power, and that conception is almost entirely boob-centric and doesn't actually care about her thought processes and planning. What happened to make her as zero-sum merciless as she is, her thought processes when it comes to protecting herself and consolidating power, we don't really get that origin story in the sense of motivations. We just get an explanation, quote unquote, repeated ad nauseam via skimpy costumes of how she deploys her influence, whether it's on strangers or her kids. There is almost nothing to play there for George except some homages to or hints at Barkin's performance in previous seasons, which were actually pretty skillful when the flashbacks were getting closer to the present day. If there had been a woman of any influence in the writer's room, George might have had a shot at making this an interesting character. As it is, it was just a lot of repetition, a lot of pretty misogynistic meditations on what a twisted piece of shit Janine is. It's almost fetishistically interested in how horribly she treats her only daughter. And then that daughter's child, Jay, has this only in scripted fair motivation for his lethally vengeful endgame that the actor playing him is also not equipped to play. And I'm not sure that's his fault, but that sad little shit stash wasn't helping. Someone on the production side sort of should have required him to get rid of it. I should have been required to get rid of this from my DVR two seasons ago. There are some nice performances from Sean Hattasey and Jake Weary, but it just didn't have anything to say in the last 20 episodes that it couldn't have done in three.
Oof.
It did Ellen Barkin and Layla George dirty, and I really have to start bailing on shows the minute more than three of them stack up on the DVR, because it is a sign from the universe.
Yeah, to start working on your list, the famous list.
I know, seriously. I mean, I crossed that one thing off the list, but Jesus H, at what cost? Okay, speaking of lists, hey, Mark and Sarah talk about songs, listed 40 extremely Lilith Fairish songs and ranked them. And our season finale is now out as you listen to this. You can find that at markandsarahtalkaboutsongs.com. You can find it at our Patreon, where you also get to vote on stuff and come to our happy hours and yell at us for being mean to Jules. Don't do that. That's at patreon.com/mastass. And the podcast is free wherever you get your podcasts, except Spotify, who hate us because they don't understand fair use. Anyway, the Lilith Fair 40 was a really fun season to do. Next up is Radio Hip Hop from the 80s. We're super psyched about that, too. Come along. We have a good time.
The new season of Karate Town is out. Yes, Karate Town. The follow-up to the Karate Kids, part one through four?
Three.
Sure. And yeah, so Cobra Kai is back with a new season. And there's a lot of talk going on our Extra Hot Great Discord channel about the new season. A lot of people are like, how did this happen? How did that happen? And I just keep on yelling. It's Karate Town.
Karate Town, yes.
What you have to understand to really get into the machinery that runs Cobra Kai is that it is a story about how slowly the valley in Los Angeles was converted from being on the U.S. dollar standard to being on the karate standard.
That's
where
right.
Your life, your worth, your friends, your family, they're all based on how well they do karate now.
Yeah.
Nothing else matters. Doesn't matter if you're getting good grades. It doesn't matter if you're finding love. All that matters is karate and karate honor.
It doesn't even matter if you have a business that you're supposed to run. It was, we found out at some point when they're having a karate war room in the back at Daniel's like car dealership, and someone has to come and knock on the door and be like, "Can I buy a car, please?" Which is very good. Like, the show knows what it's doing at this point, more so in season five than in season four, but.
And the thrust for the season is one character's apparent stab at world dominance through karate.
What else?
And I'm serious. Like, those are the stakes they're presenting on the show. If this guy who's taken over Cobra Kai gets his way, there'll be Cobra Kai franchises all over the world, and the youth will be under his thrall. It's a step away from Space Rockers.
It is!
From Buck Rogers. Like, the only thing they're missing is hypnotic karate moves to enchant, ensorcel the youth. But that said,
dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot, but Cobra Kai missed out on a huge viral win this season. And this is a mild spoiler, but you kind of saw it coming, even if you just watched last season with the evil Mr. Silver coming into the picture. He's the rich guy. He is the tech bro guy that is also the sensei. And he wants to franchise Cobra Kai and do all this sort of stuff. And he starts doing that. And Cobra Kai starts taking over the valley with locations on every corner. It's like Starbucks in the metropolitan area. There's a Cobra Kai in the northwest, and there's a Cobra Kai on the southeast corner of the same intersection.
That's
now.
Right.
But what they should have done, and just like slowly introduced it, is each Cobra Kai location should have taken over a visually identifiable failed franchise. Mm-hmm. So like that Cobra Kai used to be a Pizza Hut, and yep. they would just show like that sort of like half-ass computer changes they make when they just add a sign to a building because they can't be bothered to actually make a sign for production. That was obviously used to be a Dairy Queen. That was a Taco Bell. That was the Circuit City. And just like pepper them in all season to like the point where like there's 12 or 14 of them going along. People would eat that shit up online, and it totally gels with the story because they're just taking over this area and that area, and you know they're putting all their neon and high-tech stuff in there. It would have been great, like an old Blockbuster, and now it's a fucking Cobra Kai dojo.
Mwah.
They blew it.
I'm also not a crackpot, and I said this on Twitter, but they should start doing what The Challenge does with bringing in characters that were from like Are You the One and stuff, because there really isn't Road Rules in Real World anymore. Like all the people on The Challenge otherwise would just be people that were on The Challenge before. Bring in people who were like in other 80s martial arts or just fighting movies, because this season there's a plot line involving the daughter of like some sensei who created like some super brutal form of karate. And I was like, where have I seen this before? Oh yeah, there's also a sensei's daughter in Bloodsport. Like, they should have just found that lady wherever she is and had her play that part. Because that would have been better. And then, you know, this is how you also get to Hilary Swank eventually being in the Cobra Kai universe.
And lastly and shortly, Rings of Power, the Lord of the Rings show. We were off a week, so we missed this during its debut.
Watched it.
Perfectly cromulent swords and sandals sort of thing. I don't know anything about the source material. Shout out to Dave Snyder on the Discord for his wiki style answerings of all my stupid questions. Like, what are these guys and why don't they call them hobbits? Because they sure look like hobbits to me. Who you may remember, he headed up our Star Trek draft. Same guy.
Sure.
But it's fine. And the one thing I will say about it versus, say, like the Game of Thrones stuff is kind of nice to have a show where people actually wear color and there's color in the show. It's just not all brown and grays. They're actually like, you know what? Our island nation, we're really into royal blue stuff. Let's all wear royal blue uniforms and march around and be happy. And then it's a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it's fine. It's nothing special. It definitely does not deserve to have that much money spent on it, because like, it is a perfectly just like, there it is. Here's some swords. You got some elves. They're sometimes they're happy. Sometimes they're angry. Sometimes they got swords. Sometimes there's orcs. And it all looks very beautiful and very expensive, but it definitely has a feeling of like, this is what came before, you know, like this is the grandfather to all the bloodlust, dragon vomit acid stuff that you're loving today.
Dragon vomit.
Of course.
But I'm watching it and it's, you know, it's a solid B show, but I think Amazon really was thinking it was going to be a double A plus kind of affair. And it's not.
Well, the best endorsement it has is that you're still watching it, unlike House of the Dragon.
Right here on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great, coming this Friday, it is Recast This Twin Peaks Edition. We're remaking Twin Peaks in the year 2022. Who's going to be in it? And which one of us, hands up for me, went off the rails immediately with that one? And it was my idea.
Was
I didn't even follow the directive.
Nope.
And then right here in the next EHG Prime, it is Quantum Leap. Yes, we're bringing back Quantum Leap. Oh boy, he says, with a reference to the old show. Mm-hmm. And we're welcoming back Catherine Van Arendonk for that one. Don't miss it. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Our guest, Sarah Baker, is presenting this week. What do you got, Sarah?
Okay, so I didn't catch Pen 15 when it first came out. In the riches of all the delicious television that exists today, I somehow missed it. But finding myself alone, working in Atlanta without my beloved cable, I turned to Hulu and found Pen 15. From the jump, I love the show. To actually relive your middle school years is a horror that I don't think many of us would gladly undertake. But to watch these two adult women relive theirs is hilarious. At times, it's frightening. The pain and agony of being so vulnerable in an age when everything externally and internally is changing so rapidly is a beautiful and awful thing. At other times, it's deeply healing as we're able to see things that we experienced in a new light with adult eyes that remember how awful it was, but who can also see that we turned out more or less okay. There are countless excellent episodes of Pen 15, starting with its incredibly self-assured pilot, all the way through to the melancholy yet lovely series finale, too soon, I might add. But today, I enthusiastically submit Season 1, Episode 10, Dance for the Canon, as it pulls together all of the strengths of the show into a single, very eventful episode. It's also simply one of my favorites for a number of reasons. Reason 1. This episode is a perfect showcase for the two leads. Both Maya Erskine as Maya and Anna Conkle as Anna are wonderful. Maya is just extreme. Much like many 13-year-olds, she has no small reactions to anything. Maya Erskine is so incredibly expressive and just plain funny. You are both laughing at her and laughing with her. Anna Conkle is also very funny, but she has just a touch more grace and sweetness as Anna. She's also incredibly moving in the sadder moments she has to play as we see her navigate her parents' separation and divorce. It is initially very funny just on its face to see two grown women playing 13-year-olds. And to see them amongst actual 13-year-olds is initially just bizarre and funny to watch. Because of this, I'm sure some people thought Pen 15 would have all of the depth of an SNL sketch. Even the title is a joke. So when you find yourself not even noticing that they're adults anymore, it speaks to the expert writing, the director and creators getting the tone just right, and the actors' truthful portrayals of these versions of their younger selves. Reason 2. This episode features a lot of the periphery characters that really make the series sing. This may seem like a small thing, but I love the casting of these young actors. They are mostly fantastic and absolutely perfect in their ordinariness. These aren't Hollywood kids. And there's an added realism to the hottest guy in the school being in actuality a cute but very typical young man, not a Hollywood actor level teenage bombshell. If you think back to the hottest guys in your middle school, shout out to Jay Medina and Jason Rowley and the popular girls. No shout outs for them. Don't they have enough? You'll probably remember that they were just slightly above average, completely normal preteens and teens just like you. Reason 3. We get a lot with this episode. We get to see the girls fighting and then make up. We see Maya dealing with her first period, first tampon, both of their first dance, first time in a closet with a boy, first cigarette. As the episode begins, the girls are fighting. While not something that's typical for them, it accurately conveys how untethered you can feel when your very best friend is mad at you and you at her. Clip 1.
Hey.
Hey. Sorry I yelled at you last night.
Yeah, I thought I'd hear from you. Last night was just really shitty and like...
I mean, last night was really shitty for me too.
You know, guess we just can't do everything together like we thought.
When Maya hears Anna recount to other friends, and really not just any old other friends, but the most popular girls in the school, that her parents are getting divorced, Maya is crushed for Anna, and we see her looking to Anna with complete care and concern. But because she is 13, she doesn't know how to navigate her extreme hurt that Anna didn't tell her first or at all. And because she is 13, Maya can't help but make it all about her, so she storms off down the hall without saying a word to Anna. Perfectly illustrating how preteen girls have both complete codependent empathy and love for each other, but also undeveloped brains and swirling hormones that make it impossible not to put yourself at the center of every single thing. Their distance culminates in quintessential lunchroom drama featuring the previously mentioned fantastic supporting cast. Clip 2.
Okay. I'm going to tell you something, Maya. Don't freak out.
Don't say anything to me right now. What do you have to say? What? What?
All right. I heard a rumor that Heather is taking Anna to the dance.
What? What did you say? That was our plans to go to the dance together. We have a lot of plans tonight, so that's real. Oh, bitch. Okay. Okay.
Well, at least we're still going together. I mean, together as in like a group.
Hi, guys. Hey, Maya.
Hey, Jenna.
Janine.
It's Jenna.
What?
As if that weren't enough, Maya gets her first period, and as we can clearly tell from the very temporary fix of a giant wad of paper towels that she replaces in the bathroom, she has not told anyone. As many girls do, she clearly hasn't felt comfortable to tell even her mom, so she's dealing with this big life change on her own while navigating all the ordinary crap she has going on. Not to mention the inevitable embarrassment, whether it's the classic bleeding through your pants or, in Maya's case, clogging the toilet and being found out by an empathetic custodian at school. Clip 3.
Something wrong with the toilet?
No. No, you don't have to look. That's not...
You know, you can't flush pads.
No, I know. That's not a that's not mine. Because I don't have my period, so I think that's someone that put in there.
You know, it's natural. It happens to everyone.
Good for them.
Seriously, it's hard to overemphasize for the men out there just how mind-blowing the experience is, how much you still don't know about what actually happens. I remember thinking that you'd just get like a drop of blood or maybe a lot of blood all at once, but then it would be over, having no idea that it was something that lasted for days. And how much you're supposed to sort of not even acknowledge that it's happening. Whether it's your parents divorcing, getting drunk for the first time, or getting your period, this show does these traditional rites of passage so well, using such extreme specificity that they somehow represent all of us. Reason 4, the dance itself. Oh, the special outfits and hairdos that, again, are not the Hollywood version, but closer to what you'd actually be able to accomplish yourself, maybe with your mom's help. The insane, quote-unquote, sexy dancing, the height differentials between the boys and girls, the big swing on a brand new look by Anna's suddenly emo boyfriend, Brendan, the dreamy, intense music that plays every time Anna sees her ultimate crush, Alex. And yes, that music plays every time we see Alex for the entire series. Maya and Anna's adorable friend, Sam, who is clearly in love with Maya and a much better option than any of these other dupes, but Maya can't see it. Anna's bravery in asking her crush to dance, being brutally rejected, then immediately being dumped by the popular girls for not understanding that despite her being totally over him, you can't ask the popular girl's ex to dance. All seems lost. And then your song hits. The one that you and your BFF choreographed a dance to, which you do together, and everyone else melts away, and you're best friends again, and all is right with the world. Did I mention that I'm a total sap? This display of friendship and how it gets us through the most impossible moments makes me tear up every time. Reason 5. The genius of using adult actors to portray young teenagers is that they can explore things we haven't seen on TV very much. We wouldn't ask actual 13-year-old actors to endure what we ask of the adult Maya and Anna. And using body doubles for kissing, sexual scenes, and making that very obvious so you can enjoy the awkwardness of the portrayed moment and not feel worried about the awkwardness of the filmed moment is brilliant. Nowhere is this more obvious than in the painfully awkward interaction the girls have in the closet with Brandt. Clip 4.
You were both really hard-nipped.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
Wait at least a minute before you come out.
Hey.
I love you.
I love you too.
By turns, hilarious, awkward, and disturbing, the scenes with Bran in this episode exemplify the series' boldness in exploring the burgeoning sexuality of early puberty so well. And reason 6, bringing it all full circle. This episode pulls everything back together with earned poignancy. Back home after the dance, the two friends finally confront the painful elephant in the room that sparked their fight earlier and find their way back to each other. It's a beautiful moment that doesn't shy away from the awkwardness and hurt, but makes them stronger for it and the show at the same time. And of course, it all wraps up with that first cigarette, just like we all had, crouched down and hidden outside somewhere. Lit wrong, not inhaling, then inhaling and coughing, and then the very unbelievable tiny, I like it. Clip 5.
You want to go inside?
No, let's just stay out here.
In conclusion, you laugh, you cry, you cleanse yourself of the last remnants of your middle school trauma, and all in one untidy little 30-minute bow, with two strands of hair pulled out and slicked down into your eyes, just so. I hope you will awkwardly bump and grind with me and induct Pen 15's dance into the Extra Hot Great canon.
Thank you so much. Sarah Bunting, why don't you go first?
I never thought that the following sentence would come out of my mouth, so here we go. But this has Todd Solondz dipped in Romy and Michelle vibes for me.
Yes.
And that is really a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
This, like, I had not watched this show before. I knew about it. You know, you see that it describes itself or has been described as a traumedy, and I'm like, you know, I lived through this in All Girls, and I don't want to see someone else's interpretation. I thought wrong. This was so, like, gentle and sort of fond in its skewering of various aspects of this experience. I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about the choice to have them be the only two adults, but Sarah Baker is so right that it's set up with such obvious artifice that you can get in touch with the emotion of the moment and not worry that a felony is, like, happening because of the way it's filmed. And there are just so many, like, it just goes right up to the edge, but it doesn't go too far and then come back around. It just goes up to the edge of it. Like, when they're shaving their legs for the first time, and just the sound design is brutal, and you can just tell they're pressing too hard, and it's like someone's going to the hospital. I remember this moment frequently and relive it, including the bleeding to this, you know, day, because shaving your legs is hard and is a pain. And this show, I think, really gets at all the ways that it's difficult to be 13. It's difficult to be a 13-year-old girl. It's difficult to be a person. And, oh, these boys. I mean, don't tell anyone. 5 minutes, don't tell anyone. Like, oh, my God, that kid. Of course, like, every town, every school had that kid. This was really a pleasure, and also, like, fascinating to kind of turn it over and look at the back of the tapestry and see how it was made, and see and think about how they thought about making it and how this was their way into this story that might seem like it's ground that we've been over every inch of it in pop culture, but they're finding new texture and just especially, like, just little things that they don't necessarily draw attention to, like the principal announcing that this is the last freak dance, and it's like, is there a chaperone here? Like, these are children. Like, I wouldn't dance like this in front of people. Or the little hair bows that are, like, they're not quite lined up. And I think the most familiar moment to me was Heather, is that the popular girl? Mm-hmm. Just sort of, like, holding herself in and being like, you know, just so you know, that wasn't cool. And just, like, the way that there's so much unsaid in that moment. But then the most popular girls, like lieutenants, are the ones who end up doing the most damage in these situations. And it really brought me back to a certain moment in my own 7th grade year that, like, you know, almost obscured by the mists of time, but not quite. But I also felt seen and supported by this show. So it's really quite an achievement what the show does. And I really enjoyed it and this presentation. So thank you for the introduction.
Are you describing a girls' mafia, like, capo system there, basically?
Yes.
Is that what?
Yeah. Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Girl world is, it's not for babies. It's really not.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was a delight in both presentation and experience. Tara.
Like my co-host, I had not engaged with the show either. When it was first premiering, they put out a trailer which emphasized the, like, can you believe this wacky format idea? And as soon as I watched, I don't think I even finished the trailer where I was like, this is not for me. This is so corny. This is over the top. Now I know, thanks to Sarah Baker, it is none of those things. And that was just incredibly terrible marketing, because this, it's so lovely. Like, it's so sweet, and it like, you know, the characters are them, but aren't them, of course. And they have so much, they have so much empathy for the people that they were then, and how, you know, these are the biggest crises you will ever go through in your life. And like, you know, some of this is like, well, they're 13 and they're overblowing it, but some of it is not. Like, getting your first period and your parents getting divorced, that's huge shit. Like, that's big. That's as big as it gets when you're a teenager, or a, you know, a preteen or a tween or whatever. I guess 13 is a teenager. The scene with the janitor, she's just so nice about it. God bless Diane Delano, wonderful character actress.
So good.
Just so, you know, and you get the feeling in that scene like she's done this. She's definitely done this before.
Weekly.
Like, she's helped
she's
another
like, you know,
kid.
You can't flush pads.
Yes. But she's also helped someone by being like, look, here's a tampon. It's no big deal. And then to cut from that to Maya having the tampon out of the applicator, it is like the size of
size
a bolster
of a toaster,
pillow.
Right? I mean, I remember that moment too, that it was like, they want me to do what?
Exactly. Yeah. And then that into the leg shaving scene, which is like, they've ritualized it so much. And the mom's being like, once you start, you can never stop. Are you sure you want to do this? And then just the cut to them and Maya's legs, like, looking like a stevedores. I mean, it's just, everything about it is gorgeous. Sarah Baker also already mentioned the dance attire, that our heroines are just going in, like, the fancy version of what they always wear. Like, they're called paddle pushers, the dumb, like, butterfly barrettes. And then the contrast with the popular girls in their, like, diaphanous bias cut slip dresses, because they get to be a different kind of girl in the late 90s, early 2000s. It's all of it is perfect. The dance, like, bringing them back together, this, you know, doing their choreography to the song and then making peace at the end, and then the scandalous one cigarette that Maya has been saving for this perfect moment. Like, it all felt so true. And Sarah, you're totally right that you forget that they're adults, like, fairly quickly, because they're so good, and the non-Disney Channel kids that are surrounding them are so good too. I hope Janine, whoever that actress is living her best life now, because she is so funny in that part. Just like the overly possessive grade 8 girlfriend of the guy who clearly is not that into her. All of it was great. So thank you so much for bringing it to us. And I have a lot to catch up on, even though you would think doing Listen to Sassy has made me revisit these years a lot in my own life, but apparently I still want more. So this was great. Thank you, Dave.
Hey, what's up? The sun.
Oh, my God. And just the whole table
is
like,
I almost let that in, but I didn't want the clip to be too long.
Yeah, this was really good. And I feel like it does feel familiar to me, because we spent the last couple of years with Pamela Ribbon doing Listen to Sassy, which is a recounting of Sassy magazine, which isn't exactly the same time period, but is
not
exactly the same issues and
but I mean, and I feel like Dennis is definitely in definitely in the background of a couple shots.
It's true. Some things never change.
Yeah. So I think I might have had more questions if this was a candidature before Listen to Sassy. But if you enjoy this discussion, definitely check out that podcast, listentosassy.com. There's two moments where this won me over, just like outside of its genuine sort of heartfelt tackling of all the shit that goes on in high school. One was the menace of Maya's stare during the shaving ritual. Accompanied by the sound design of a razor going through the jungle that was a 42-year-old man's legs on set. And the other one was the sun. I don't know why. That was just took me back. Like, there was something about just that that tells you exactly where that character is in sort of a in her development, you know, mm-hmm. just like perfect, just like a perfect little piece of business there. And yeah, I was really confused for the first 5 seconds about what exactly was going on with the actors. And, you know, and then it all settles down very quickly. Like, you're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't take long for your brain to normalize everything where it needs to be to watch adults function as high school students among high school students. So really good, strangely familiar now TV show. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really smart, really funny. And I was trying to figure out where I knew Maya from. She was in Obi-Wan Kenobi for like a hot second.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It also may have inspired me to do a Whit Stillman revisit because Taylor Nichols as the dad is.
Did you also notice Sarah Garrett Slan is one of the dads when they're taking photos for the right before the dance? 90210's own stalker, Garrett Slan.
Yeah. Hashtag everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
I will dance with this one. It's a yes for me.
Tara Ariano?
Yes for me as well.
Me too. So that means... Pen 15, Season 1, Episode 10, Dance! You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, speaking of Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars TV universe, our winner is Lee Jung-jae of Squid Game, first because he's going to be headlining the Star Wars series The Acolyte. Dave, what is the show about?
Well, we don't know for sure, but it's set way back in the past from anything else we've seen so far. A couple hundred years, mm-hmm. and it's mostly about evil side stuff. It's also very hazy. Nobody knows a lot about it.
Okay. It's from Leslie Headland, who wrote and directed Bachelorette, that movie from 10 years ago now, maybe. So that is also compelling. And he also became the first Asian actor ever to win a Best Actor Emmy in the drama category for his role in Squid Game. So big week for that guy. Congratulations to him.
Well, around the topic of Squid Game, a few days ago on the Patreon Discord, we were using this thing called like YouTube Sound Doubler or something like that to take the video from one TV theme and put it onto the music of another. And somebody did a fucking pitch perfect. I'm sorry, I don't have your name in front of me. I totally would give you an ups of the graphics for the opening of Squid Game. You remember it was all just like, you know, the characters and they change and they become Squid Game. Perfectly synced to the theme to the Mindy Project. And it was
that was so good. Mwah, yes.
It was absolutely the best one we did. And I thought that was absolutely great. All right, loser of the week, Sarah.
Big week for John Oliver. Our loser is Dick Wolf, who was dragged by John Oliver on Last Week Tonight for promulgating propaganda. I have not watched this rant yet, but I will hear it at some point because my husband watches these on his computer like way too loud because he's trying to get me to the show. Like, fine. It's an institution. John Oliver also won an Emmy yesterday as we record this. And joked about the Queen's death, which was cut for the broadcast on Sky. So, yeah, keeping himself front and center, John Oliver.
Speaking of keeping yourself front and center, do you know what time it is?
Good time!
Is it non-regulation game time?
Oh. Exactly. We're doing another non-regulation game time because Dave was really tired yesterday and I offered and he said, okay, yes. And I was like, no, no. So then I put this together. This game is called Call Them. And to pick up where we left off with our lead topic, it is a game about sex workers on television. I'm going to describe a TV scenario in which someone's doing sex work. If you can get it off the initial description, it is worth 3 points. If you need a hint, I will tell you the network and the years the show was or is on, and then it's worth 2 points. If you still need a hint, I'll tell you either the actor who played the sex worker or someone who was or could have been their client, whichever makes the answer, in my opinion, more gettable, then it is worth 1 point. Obviously, no show is in here more than once. They're also not all shows about sex work. Some of them are particular episodes of unrelated shows. And because it's a non-regulation game time, you can guess at every level. We're skipping steel meals, etc. If Dave wins, he can make me write a future non-regulation game time, ideally with a little more than 18 hours notice next time, Dave. And if either Sarah wins, they get 3 steel meals for themselves or their team. Does anyone have any questions? We have 18 questions and a tiebreaker. Let us throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with David.
All right, so...
Come.
Our order is David, Sarah Baker, Sarah D. Bunting. Are you ready to play Call Them?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, question number 1 for Dave. If you're lonely in Westeros, hit up Littlefinger's brothel to buy some company. What is the show?
Honestly, I don't know the name of the prostitutes in Game of Thrones. This is Game of Thrones, which I just said. Game of Thrones.
Good for 3 points.
Game of Thrones.
Question number 2 is for Sarah Baker. If you linger over your fries down the street from the Wonder Wharf, you might see Marshmallow stroll by with her friends.
Bob's Burgers.
Bob's Burgers, correct for 3 points, sorry. To Sarah D. Bunting. Wartime Vietnam can be a challenging place, but you could take your mind off things if you have a few dollars for the company of a friendly strawberry blonde.
Oh, China Beach.
China Beach is correct. Back to Dave.
Yeah.
Disdaining your biggest acting bloody rival doesn't mean you need to stop having sex with his free-spirited wife.
Once again?
Disdaining your biggest acting bloody rival doesn't mean you need to stop having sex with his free-spirited wife.
Ray Bloody Purchase. I believe this is Toast of London.
Correct.
No. There we go.
Mrs. P.
Oops.
Best flyers out for her services. Back to Sarah Baker. Gilead keeps its female residents in line with extremely restrictive laws and practices, but some who choose to live outside the system can entertain you at your local Jezebels.
Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Dick Van Dyke Show. Wait, Gilead. Oh, wait, we were just talking about it. The ladies with the red hats.
Nope, they're white.
Oh, the ladies with the red gowns and white hats. I've never watched the show, but I auditioned for it. Stalling.
They look like a bunch of hockey players from the Detroit Red Wings.
Handmaid's
running
Tale.
There it is for 3 points. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Steven Soderbergh directed the movie that this series was based on, but you're not going to see his star, former adult film performer Sacha Grey, getting down in its various tastefully neutral TV locations.
Wow, already mentioned today.
Yeah, by me, I think.
Yeah.
Girlfriend experience?
It was. I was like, this is the one where I was like, does she remember what the show is? And you did. I'm surprised Dave remembered what the show is.
I mean, they're all on the list.
Basically. I remember it because I just heard it half an hour ago.
Right. We also did watch the movie with Will Edmondson, as I recall.
Yeah, right.
Back to Dave.
Yeah.
Passing through Seattle, need a date for a professional function and maybe more. The most elegant women in town await you at Executive Match.
Ooh. Once more, please.
Passing through Seattle and need a date for a professional function and maybe more. The most elegant women in town await you at Executive Match.
Huh.
You can ask for a hint.
Yeah.
You can also guess for free.
That's right. I forgot. Well, I don't remember it, but I guess my first guess is just going to be Frasier. Oh, okay.
And you should know.
What?
You're Frasier.
Niles thinks that Executive Match is a matchmaking service. And then Donnie finds out when he's representing a guy who used their services.
Because I was thinking of two things about Frasier. One was the last season dating thing with Laura Linney.
Yes.
And then the other one was the prostitute pickup in the car storyline, which had nothing to do with the service. So that's why when my brain was searching for a third thing.
Well, you got there, and that's what counts. Sarah Baker, everything in this placid mountain town seems wholesomely all-American until you wander away from your coffee and pie and into One-Eyed Jack's.
Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks is correct.
Bobby would have killed me if I got that wrong.
Thank God.
This is the water, and this is the well.
Back to Sarah Deventing, and then we'll have a score break, but I'm pretty sure I know what it is. Here's your question, Sarah. Finances can be challenging for any divorced father, never mind one who's scraping by as a high school teacher, so it's lucky for this show's hero that he has an absolutely gigantic penis perfect for work as a suburban gigolo.
Okay. I feel like this involves history's greatest and apparently best hung acting robot. Is this Hung?
Yes, but David Duchovny's on it. That's you're thinking of Californication. This was Thomas Jane.
Oh, right. All right.
AKA oh. The Punisher.
All right, let's get them scores.
It's all tied up at 9 apiece. We're all batting 1,000. Good job, everybody.
Bad job to me for making this game too easy. Back to Dave.
Yeah.
Space cowboys in a space western need love too, and apparently it's no big deal having a sex worker live on their spaceships full time.
Huh. Oh, right. This is, Firefly.
Correct.
I was about to say Farscape. I almost said Farscape. You imagine how mad people would be if I actually answered Farscape? Our house would be in ashes by this time tomorrow.
To Sarah Baker. A futuristic theme park set in a frontier town wouldn't be complete if guests couldn't do whatever they want with robot prostitutes.
Okay, I almost said West Wing, but I think this is West World.
West Wing also had a sex worker, played by Lisa Edelstein, yes. But yes, it is West World.
She did.
Oh, my friend Lisa Edelstein.
She was in the pilot as a Rob Lowe conquest.
Mm-hmm.
To Sarah D. Bunting. This Los Angeles lady had quite a life. Recruited as a teen by a pimp with a wildly improbable name, just a couple of short decades later becoming a skeevy doctor's fourth wife.
A skeevy... Jesus. Melrose Place.
Oh, yeah.
I just lost track of which skeevy doctor and how many wives.
That's right.
Sometimes it's so close. It's just like just in your peripheral vision.
To Dave.
Yeah.
The most beautiful women in 19th century San Francisco can be found at a brothel in Chinatown, but beware the madam. She is a very skilled martial artist.
This probably is Warrior.
Correct. To Sarah Baker. Sarah Baker. David Simon series introduces viewers to all the characters plying their various grubby trades in 70s Times Square.
Oh. Yep.
Come on, Sarah, you can drop this. You can drop this answer.
Oh.
Now I got it. The deuce, right? You made me dirty in several ways with that hint.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we're all implicated.
Sorry.
It's a Sarah D. Bunting. This is one that's about an episode, not a show, or not a sex worker show. A couple of ladies who are bored by their suburban lives could do worse than start an interior decorating business as a cover for their call girl operation. Ditto a shoe manufacturer who deploys his daughter to recruit her college friends as escorts for his business associates. It's actually two different episodes.
Oh, speak of the devil, Law and Order.
That's right. The Felicity Huffman episode. Oh, yeah. All right, you each have one question left. Let's get those scores for no reason.
Still all tied up now at 15.
Oh, boy. Good thing I have a tiebreaker. Back to Dave.
Yep.
Running ops for SD6 frequently requires this part-time grad student to infiltrate parties and events in the guise of a sex worker.
Did you say SD6 at the beginning there?
Yes.
Okay, so that is Alias.
Correct. To Sarah Baker. Researching the carnal practices of mid-century Americans sometimes requires seeking the assistance of people who fornicate on a professional basis.
Masters of Sex?
Yes! I thought that was going to be one of the harder ones.
I thought I would ruin it, surely.
Sarah D. Bunting. Everyone else might clear out of New York between Christmas and New Year's, but if you want to make sure a nightclub comic doesn't mistake you and your buddy for a couple, you can count on a call girl.
Oh my God. I was about to be like, Dash and Lily? It isn't. It's Mad Men.
It is Mad Men. All right. Everyone played a perfect game.
I'd like to make a proposal at this point.
Yeah.
I think this is a really good spot for a three-way tie, so I think the tiebreaker should be best worst answer, but still everybody's tied and wins.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Okay.
Best worst answer. Best wrong answer.
Best wrong answer to this tiebreaker.
Yeah.
Too horny to pan for gold? Head to the Gem Saloon. Al will sort you out. Dave, what is your best worst answer since this was your idea?
Once again, please.
Too horny to pan for gold? Head to the Gem Saloon. Al will sort you out.
Rachel Ray.
Sarah Baker.
Happy Days.
Sarah DiMonte.
Married with Children.
I gotta give it to Happy Days.
Yeah. I mean, and they are.
All right, everybody gets everything they wanted. Thank you for playing my way too easy game.
That was Happy Days.
No, they weren't all Happy Days.
Okay, wait, hang on.
Valued guest.
Everybody
we all
wins.
Did it.
Yay, oh, sex God. Workers. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took off our pants one leg at a time for the reimagining of American Gigolo before going around the dial with stops at Monarch, The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Animal Kingdom, Cobra Kai, and The Rings of Power. Sarah got Pen 15 into the C4N0N. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and everybody was a winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, it's recasting Twin Peaks on Extra Extra Hot Great. And right here on EHG Prime next week, it's Quantum Leap. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I love you too.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Once you start, you can never stop.
And Sarah Baker.
It's Jenna.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
You fuck butt! Go fuck a dick till it comes, suck face!
You know, for kids.